been paying attention, I think we're heading in almost the exact opposite direction of the lake. When we reach the town limits, he turns onto a country highway I've never been down. And from there, onto a one-lane dirt road labeled private. The cornfields and rows of soy give way to trees. Through the branches ahead, the sky is fading from orange to a thinner yellow light. The ribbon of dirt we bump along seems to go on forever. How much land does this guy own? I wonder aloud.
Probably half the county. The person I spoke to, I think it was his secretary or else his personal assistant or something, said the camp would be a ways up on the left, and that there was no way to miss it.
This turns out to be an understatement, since the camp is really nothing of the sort. It's a compound with a three-story log house at the center that is reached by a crushed gravel drive. The house sits near the center of a grassy clearing with several other smaller buildings set on either side. A line of Adirondack chairs is visible on a porch, and more are scattered across the lawn. Dad lets out a low whistle.
Is this the sort of place you get when your likability numbers are high?
He asks. I think it's the sort of place you get when your net worth is high, regardless of whether you're likable or not.
I never knew this was back here,
he says, as the tires begin to crunch over the drive. I'm pretty sure that was the idea. We are greeted almost immediately by two lumbering coonhounds who snap and bite at the tires until we've stopped. Then they sit down, tails wagging while they wait for Dad and me to climb out of the truck. I let the dog closest to me sniff at my hand and then give him a scratch behind the ears. The door to the house opens and his head swings around at the sound.
I see you've met Ringo,
a man calls out from the porch.
And that rascal over there is Star.
Star looks balefully up at Dad and is rewarded with a perfunctory pat on his head.
Come on, boys,
the man says. And for a few seconds, I'm not sure if he's talking to the dogs or to Dad and me. But then Ringo and Star take off and bolt through the door the man is holding open. He lets it bang shut, and then steps heavily off the porch and moves to greet us.
Welcome. I recognize you, Rort, from all those interviews you've been doing. I guess that makes you Mr. Richards. I don't think we've met. I'm Gulliver Lester. You can call me Gull. Most everybody does. I'm Ellery's old man. This here's my place. Come on in, I'll introduce you around. I think there are a few people you don't already know.
Gulliver starts back toward the house, and we follow. He walks with just a trace of a limp, and at one point I almost bump into him, when he stops suddenly to hike up his trousers. So I give him kind of a wide berth after that. When we reach the door, Ringo and Star are waiting, noses pressed to the screen. But they back off when Gulliver waves them away and retreat to a pair of low cushions next to the stone fireplace. Caleb stands quickly as we enter the room and extends his hand.
Mr. Richards, it's a pleasure to finally meet you.
He greets my father warmly, then claps me on the back as if we're old friends. I force myself not to pull away from his touch. But he leaves the hand there, and so eventually I have to duck across the room. I cover this escape by shaking hands with Ellery, and he introduces me to Gulliver's business associate, a severe-looking man named Carl, whose eyes are set so far apart that he appears almost cartoonish. I gather that both he and Gulliver have plans to invest heavily in Caleb's campaign, and are exploring forming their own political action committee.
I don't think I'm allowed to be here if you're going to talk strategy, Caleb says, prompting the older men to laugh good-naturedly and look very pleased with themselves.
You won't get any arguments here,
Gulliver answers. Besides,
I think Hillary's pretty much got the strategy worked out. We'll just be here when you need us.
It's clear that Gulliver is proud of his son. And while everything about this gathering feels heavily scripted, that emotion strikes me as honest enough. I watch Ellery shrug. Obviously, he's used to being adored. He says nothing, but instead turns back to my dad and they resume chatting. My father, who in general is shy around new people, actually looks like he's enjoying himself. I eye the large brass clock on the mantle and try to calculate how long I can last without saying something that I will regret. Caleb smiles at me expectantly, and I realize that I haven't been listening to whatever he's been saying. I gamble and decide to just smile in response, and this appears to satisfy him. He continues on with a story about Ellery behaving badly in Paris, which Gulliver seems to think is a real humdinger based on the number of times he calls it that and smacks his knee. Soon the camera crew arrives. I don't recognize them. Caleb or Ellery must have hired them directly. Ellery takes them into another room and then reappears a short while later.
"Everyone ready?" he asks.
His father lets out a noise that I suspect is meant to indicate gusto, but comes out sounding like a belch. Gulliver stands and leads the way outside. There's a small lake or pond behind the house that you couldn't see from the drive. Mist is rising off the water. It's the sort of view that only money can buy. Once all of the men have gathered their gear, they stand around complimenting one another on their choice of firearm. I look on, a little apart from the circle. Caleb passes his shotgun over for my father to examine, while the film crew gets some wide shots of the group of us, with the water in the background. My father turns the camouflaged weapon over in his hands.
"This is one of mine," he says appraisingly.
"It is," Caleb answers.
"Good eye. My father bought that from you when I turned 16. I always thought of it as the gun that turned me into a man."
Dad hands the shotgun back to Caleb and then holds out his own.
"This here, now it isn't fancy, but it served me well. It was a gift from my daddy too. I guess there's something to be said for holding on to the things that matter, even if shinier objects might come your way."
Caleb laughs and slaps my father on the back.
"I like that. Do you mind if I borrow that line?"
Dad looks embarrassed and offers a non-committal grunt in reply. Caleb seems to take this as a yes and looks over at me.
"Rourke, your father here is a real gem. I hope you appreciate that."
Gulliver starts in on a description of the property, where the blinds are set up, the clearings where they've seen the most tracks. The turkeys can be heard calling in the distance, and the same mist that's coming off the lake is still hugging the shallow hollows in some places. It swirls around Ellery's boots. We head out on foot and disperse, the dogs flanking Gulliver closely. The camera team trails behind us, keeping Caleb in their sights. I try to fan out to the left, away from Caleb, but he beckons me closer. The cameramen skirt around us, clomping heavily over the uneven terrain. The noise they're making is certain to scare off any birds that are within earshot, but Caleb looks unconcerned. It's more important to look like a hunter than to actually hunt, I suddenly realize. He adjusts his shotgun and then slings it back over his shoulder in a practiced movement. I should have asked Essie if he's a good shot, or whether I need to be worried that he might accidentally hit me in the face like that vice president did to his friend a while back. But of course I didn't get the chance. Caleb points and says, "There's a blind set up right over there." He guides me toward a spot where the trees thin out. There's a meadow beyond. It's covered with untidy tufts of what look like tall grass.
That's some chufa there. The turkeys dig up the tubers.
I look attentive for the camera, but really I'm imagining what it would feel like to break Caleb's nose with the barrel of my shotgun as he prattles on.
Gull used to plant corn, but this is much better. This plot here attracts twice the number of birds for a fraction of the work.
I wonder who exactly did that work, since I doubt very much it was Gulliver himself.
Maybe Ellery grew up working the land, dirt beneath his fingernails, his back bent beneath the sun.
Maybe Gull was one of those rich men who grew up poor and wanted his son to know what that feels like, to know that hunger. Not for food necessarily, but for a better life, for success, for power.
So maybe Gull did send Ellery out here with a hoe and some seed corn when they were setting up this camp. But it's not likely.
I think this, and then reconsider.
I look over at Caleb and remind myself that you never can tell what a family is like from the outside looking in.
He has reached the small shelter and we settle in. He tells me there's a roost not too far off, and we listen for the telltale call of a gobbler in search of a mate.
Caleb raises a turkey call to his lips and, using his diaphragm, lets out a series of yelps.
I scan the area for movement, one hand on my shotgun, aware that the camera crew is blocking the direction I would be most likely to shoot in. From far off in the distance, I hear the sharp report of a gun, and I wonder who it was that took the shot, knowing there will be no way to avoid a full retelling when we reconvene at the camp in a few hours' time.
Caleb cocks his head, but does nothing else to acknowledge the sound. He keeps his eyes on a stand of tall oaks just at the edge of the meadow.
"Your father taught you to hunt, didn't he, Rourke?"
He's leaning comfortably against a tree, peeking out of the blind. He doesn't look at me as he talks. The cameras are close, and in any case, he's probably mic'd. So I remind myself not to say anything I don't want on tape.
"He did," I reply, keeping my voice low.
"How about yours?"
"Goodness, no. Daddy is not what you would call rugged. His books, his ideas, that's the world he lives in, not this one.
It's how he's able to bring people closer to God, because he lives in that space between the earthly and the divine."
It's a well-thought-out speech, and Caleb delivers it easily. It occurs to me that the question about hunting was merely a setup, and I've played right into his hand. I can already picture how this scene will be cropped and edited for a commercial. He's praising his father, but at the same time setting himself apart. Caleb is offering himself up as the everyman alternative. A grittier, more hands-on version of the man Caleb's would-be constituents already know they love. I'm tempted to pick my nose to ruin the shot. But I keep my hands jammed deep down in my pockets to control them. I've unconsciously balled them into fists while Caleb was speaking. That is why, when the turkey appears, it is Caleb who is ready to pull the trigger. I see it first, but am still scrabbling to even raise my gun when Caleb takes the kill. He looks at me sheepishly and says,
"Sorry. I hope you don't mind."
I shrug as if it's nothing, but I'm fuming. And it has nothing to do with the turkey. My finger plays over the trigger as Caleb jogs out to examine the bird. It would be so easy, I think. Hunting accidents happen all the time. I see the cameras turn to follow Caleb, and I flex my finger just slightly. No one would know. I could say the gun misfired, or that my hand slipped and it went off when it fell. The only problem is that Caleb probably wouldn't die. He would just bleed and it would be all on camera. Not my shooting him, but the impact.
the bird shot tearing through the fabric of his vest. And once he recovered, he would be like a man risen from the dead. He would forgive me, publicly and with great fanfare, and I would have only succeeded in making him stronger. I dropped my gun to my side. Then Caleb calls out from the clearing.
He's a real beauty. Do you think you can give me a hand?
I stand up.
Sure, I call back. That's what family's for.
Time passes more quickly after that. Caleb and I separate, and I find a tree with a low, inviting branch and lie there for a while, my feet up against the trunk. A gobbler saunters by, and I don't even try for my gun. I just watch the way he struts across the forest floor, the light and shadow playing on his feathers. He belongs in this place much more than I do. In other circumstances, I would gladly bring him home for dinner, but today it feels like killing things for pride is Caleb's game, and it's not a game I want to play. My watch chirps softly to signal that it's time to head back, and reluctantly I lower myself to the ground and begin to make my way toward camp. I've heard a few other shots while I was waiting for the clock to run out, and as we gather again in the clearing by the house, I see that my father has brought in a turkey not much smaller than the one that I saw. There's the requisite padding of backs and placing bets on just how heavy each of the birds is. Ringo and Star drink from the pond and then lay their long, sleek bodies down on the part of the dock that hangs over the water. Finally, Gulliver holds up his hands and announces,
"Food will be ready soon. Why don't we all go in to clean up?"
Dad has packed us both a change of clothes, and Ellery shows us to a room upstairs with a four-poster bed and an adjacent bathroom where we can change. Unlike the downstairs, which smelled of pine and leather, this guest suite feels airier. There's a bowl of dried purple flowers on the dresser and embroidered throw pillows on the chair. A woman has been here, even if only to decorate. Ellery mentioned as we climbed the stairs that his father had bought this land on his recommendation, after Ellery had visited it with Caleb during their first year of law school. The way he tells it, Gull bought the parcel sight unseen and had the house built after. I wonder if this bowl of flowers is how Ellery's mother approached the matter of her husband having a retreat where she would rarely, if ever, be allowed. If she walked through the house at the beginning, right after the builders had gone and the furniture had been delivered, and left little tokens here and there. Evidence of her existence, a reminder to her menfolk that she was never far away. The table is laid with sandwiches and a candied ham when Dad and I come down from changing. I'm hungry, but I go outside to pack the truck first, so that we can make a quick getaway as soon as it's allowed. When I come back inside, Dad and the others have already made up plates and brought their food out back. I pile a plate with ham and potato salad and make my way to the porch. There's a round metal tub of drinks filled to the brim with ice, and I fish around for a soda and pull out a Coke. Gull laughs at this and says,
"Don't worry, the cameras have all gone. I think you can have a beer."
I look over at Dad, and he nods. Whether in agreement or because he doesn't want to make waves, I can't tell. But in any case, I shove the Coke back down into the ice and pull out a Miller Lite. The top twists off easily, and I drop the bottle cap into a small silver dish that seems to have been put out just for this purpose. I find an empty chair and rest the plate on my lap. The bottled beer tastes mustier than the cheap cans I'm used to, and I sip it slowly. Soon Gulliver leads Dad back into the house to show him some painting that he's just bought at auction. Carl stands up to follow them. This leaves only Caleb and me on the porch, while Ellery walks up and down the dock below, practically yelling into his phone. Caleb switches chairs so he's sitting next to me.
"Thanks for coming today, Rourke," he says.
It really means a lot.
What I should say is you're welcome, and leave it at that. I almost make myself do it, too. But then Caleb continues talking.
You're a lucky man. Luckier than you know.
I hate everything about him in that moment. His straight teeth and his perfect skin. But most of all, the way his eyes are half closed, as if he doesn't think he has to worry that I might use my fork to stab him. I grip the armrests on my chair and feel my chest begin to pound.
Why did you invite us today?
I ask Caleb. And don't tell me you care about my family store.
I think it's important for us to get to know one another.
Impulsively, I say, really? I already feel like I know you. Essie has talked about you a lot.
Has she?
Caleb opens his eyes fully and briefly looks unsettled. But this passes, and all too soon his smile has returned.
I know things about you as well.
Okay, I say, not at all sure what he's hinting at.
I got sent to Holden Park, too. Or did you think you were the only one?
We're not as different as you would like to believe. I feel the color drain from my face, and all at once I am back there. I can feel the darkness like something palpable, something you could touch. No, that's not right. Something that was touching you. I speak slowly and through clenched teeth. I am nothing like you. Caleb ignores this and instead says flippantly, I didn't really care for it there myself.
Too much talk, talk, talk.
The director going on endlessly about personal goals. It was tiresome. Personal goals was a misnomer, since they were written ahead of time in bullet points by the staff and by your parents.
Did you meet them?
Your goals? I say, with an edge to my voice. At this, Caleb laughs out loud.
I think you know the answer to that.
They didn't really take.
Liberty. By the third day, we have fallen into a sort of rhythm. Mike wakes up first so he can get to campus in time for torts, and tiptoes around the apartment in the dark, bumping into furniture and muttering obscenities. I wake to the sound of him tripping over a pair of shoes he didn't remember to throw into his closet when we finally went to bed 3 hours ago. Sorry, he says, and kisses my forehead as I struggle to re-enter consciousness. Don't be, I tell him. I need to get back to it. I'll see you after class. My arms and legs are heavy beneath the covers, and I can feel the weight of them pulling me deeper. I'm tempted to shut my eyes for just 20 more minutes, but as I think this, I feel the brush of Justice's nightgown against my cheek, and I shiver despite the heat coming off the radiator and force myself to get out of bed. At the sink, I splash water on my face and stare into the mirror, hands flat on the counter, wondering what Justice would look like if she were alive today. Right after she died, I used to lock myself in the upstairs bathroom of our farmhouse and sit facing the full-length mirror that was hung on the inside of that door. I would tuck my knees beneath my chin and wrap my arms around my legs and stare into that other world behind the glass, the one where Justice's face was looking back. Sometimes I even talked to her, that version of my sister who lived within the mirror's depths. But the walls were thin, and I stopped as soon as I realized that Mama could hear, because I didn't want to make her sad. No, that's a lie. That's not why I stopped. I stopped because I didn't want Mama to think I was weak. I didn't want her to be reminded that I was the reason Justice died. I blink and look deeper into the mirror, and for a moment I am that girl again, the one who believes in Wonderland. "What would you do?" I whisper to my reflection. "Would you let her tear apart her family? Would you help Essie burn it to the ground?" A fly knocks into the bulb above the sink, drawing my eyes upward and breaking the spell. When I look back into the mirror, I see only myself, eyes bloodshot from too much coffee and too little sleep, hair in tangles. I don't look like Justice anymore. I don't even look like the version of myself that graced the inner flap of my book jacket those many years ago. But at least the face that looks back at me is honest. At least now, I know exactly who I am. I shake Margot, who had passed out on the couch, and she growls about all of the different ways she would like to punish me for waking her, while I grind beans to make more coffee. There's still half a pot left over from the night before, but I pour it down the sink. We'll need the good stuff to get us going and take Margot's mind off of murdering me outright. I tell her to call her wife, but she's too busy swearing at me to hear. "I was thinking," I call out from the kitchen, interrupting Margot's description of how I deserve to be run over by a miniature car that has been stuffed full of clowns. "Maybe we should move the section about their first trip to St. John to one of the later chapters." "Like a sort of flashback, you mean? I guess that could work." Margot rises from the couch and then slouches against the kitchen counter, eyes on the steady drizzle of coffee sputtering into the pot. "But if we flash back to the years when Essie was young, then where does the story start?" "It starts now," I say. And I think again of the face I see when I look in the mirror, the one that it took me so long to find. "It starts with the person she's decided to become."
"And who exactly is that?"
I shake my head to clear it, but the thing that had seemed so obvious to me only a few seconds before retreats into the fog. I pull two mugs down from the cupboard and pour out the coffee. Take a sip. "Maybe," I say slowly, "we've been looking at the story all wrong. We've been building up to the rapes as if they justify everything that comes after. As if suffering that sort of violence at the hands of a family member is what drove Essie to fake a relationship with Rourke and try to buy her way to freedom. We've been using the rape to explain away the money those two will be getting for their marriage, for the wedding, for pretending to be something they're not."
"You don't think it does justify all that? You don't think she's entitled to every cent she can get?"
"Sure I do. And screw anyone who says otherwise, but still, this shouldn't be a story about a victim."
"What is it then?" Margot asks.
"It's a story about a mother." Margot is silent for a time. She holds her mug between her hands as if drawing warmth directly into her palms. Then, abruptly, she turns and crosses the living room, sets her cup down on the coffee table, and begins to select pieces of paper seemingly at random from the piles arranged on the floor. I follow and stand waiting beside her until she thrusts a stapled section of the diary into my hand and taps the page to indicate a paragraph near the top. "Here," she says. "This should be chapter one." She relinquishes the sheaves of paper that are labeled Esther 16 and sits down to wait for my reaction. As soon as I start to read, I know that Margot is right. Essie's story begins right here.
When Mother was five, Grandma Lou drove a knife into her husband's left thigh and left him bleeding in a lawn chair while she went inside to call the police. The chair was the kind that folded, with the seat and back woven from plastic tubing that had gone sticky after so many years out in the sun. Mother remembers this because it was her job to hose off the blood after her stepfather had been taken away in an ambulance, and Grandma Lou had been placed in handcuffs in the back of the sheriff's car. Mother was barefoot. She only had one pair of shoes, and she couldn't afford to ruin them. As she sprayed down the chair where her stepfather had sat bleeding, the water pooled on top of the dry earth and made a pink, frothy puddle that lapped at her toes. It ran past the cinder blocks on which their small house rested and drove away a stray dog who had taken shelter in the shade. Mother felt proud that she had thought to take off her shoes. Her older brother, Cyrus, would not have remembered, and then they would have been stained and no longer presentable. Cyrus was always getting beaten for one thing or another, and yet he never seemed to learn. Mother, on the other hand, learned early. This was something she prided herself on. I should say here that it wasn't Grandma Lou doing the beating. It was the man in the folding lawn chair, the man Grandma Lou had stabbed. But Mother needn't have worried about getting beaten over a pair of dirty shoes, because she never saw that man again. Grandma Lou was unshackled and released from the police car without even a trip down to the station. She shook the sheriff's hand and then went into the house to pack. Everything they owned fit in four tattered suitcases, which she had loaded into the back of their second-hand station wagon by the time Cyrus came home from school. They drove for what seemed like 3 days straight, until they ran out of money for gas. Grandma Lou would do odd jobs in whatever town they found themselves in, until she made enough to fill up the tank. They slept in parking lots for the better part of a month. What Mother remembers best is crying herself to sleep every night, blaming Grandma Lou for their misfortunes and missing the only home she had ever known. The point of this story, when Mother tells it, is how Grandma Lou let her temper get the better of her. By then, the woman was long dead and could not argue with this assessment. Maybe she wouldn't have. I don't know. I never met her. But I do know that this story was Mother's way of letting us know that everything we had as a family had been built on character. Her character. The character of a woman who prided herself on quiet deliberation and dispassionate logic, on never losing her head. Mother was the sort of woman who often said things like, "Let cooler heads prevail," or "simmer down," or even, for one mortifying summer, "take a chill pill." That last one I begged her not to say in public. And lucky for me, it didn't test well with audiences, so she agreed to give it up. It took me years of hearing Mother tell the tale of how Grandma Lou chose to make her children homeless in a fit of rage, to finally ask the obvious question. What had her stepfather done to deserve it? Why had Grandma Lou taken out the kitchen knife and stabbed him? She must have known there would be no taking it back once it was done. So what was it that made it worth all that they would lose? At this, Mother's eyes glazed over and she said, "I really don't remember." "You must," I insisted, sure that she was hiding something because she remembered everything else there was to remember about that day, right down to the fact that her single pair of shoes was the only thing that they had forgotten, the only thing that got left behind. "He hit me," she then said reluctantly. "He did that sometimes if we broke something or woke him up when he was sleeping. He whipped us with his belt until our legs or backs were bleeding. But that day I hadn't done anything and he whipped me anyway. That day he beat me just for fun." That's when I realized that Mother had been telling the story wrong for all those years. Grandma Lou's temper wasn't her fatal flaw, though that was the way Mother always spoke of it. It was her strength and her redemption. She had not acted recklessly. No. She had plunged the knife into his leg as an act of measured caution, to let him know what she would be capable of if he ever struck her child again. To make sure, before she took her family away, that he had been clearly warned and would not follow. Mother may have been too close to see it, but Grandma Lou was never the villain. True, she had brewed her fair share of moonshine, and even gone to jail for a spell when a police officer made the mistake of trying to blackmail his way into a cut of her profits from the still. Even so, she was never the black sheep of our family. It was just the opposite. She was the hero.
Margot and I are in the exact same spots where we've spent much of the previous 2 days when Mike comes back a few hours later. "How's class?" I ask without looking up. "Riveting," he answers, with more than a touch of sarcasm, and throws himself into a chair. "How are things going here?" "Pretty well, believe it or not. We've rearranged the early chapters, and I think the book reads much better now. I'm beginning to think it might actually be possible to have it ready by the rehearsal dinner so that Essie can take a final look." "So she's really going to go through with this?" "It looks that way, and I don't see any reason why she shouldn't."
"I guess you wouldn't,"
he tells me. "What is that supposed to mean?" I ask, even though I already know. Mike shrugs and doesn't answer. It's Margot who says out loud what we're all thinking. "Because you did the same thing and your life is better for it. You are happier without your parents, but who's to say Essie will feel the same when all's said and done? There are ways to get to Caleb, but not lose her entire family."
"Maybe she won't lose them."
Now Mike does speak, if only to say,
"I think you know better."
They're both right, but it's not something I want to talk about. I'm relieved when my phone rings, even though I don't recognize the number. I shoot Mike a look that I hope is defiant, and take my phone into the hall. When I hang up, I stand looking at my phone long after the screen has gone dark, not at all sure what I should do next.
"Who was it?"
Mike asks, when it becomes clear that I'm not going to volunteer this information. I don't answer because my mouth has forgotten how to speak. Eventually, I manage to say, "It was him. It was Caleb Hicks." Suddenly, Mike and Margot are talking over each other, but I can't understand anything that either of them is saying, even though their lips are working furiously. It feels like minutes have passed by the time my ears are able to focus on Margot's voice, and I hear her ask, "What in God's name does that asshat want?" "He wants to take us to dinner," I answer, and from their faces I can see that more is expected. "Not you," I tell Margot. "Don't worry, just Mike and me. He and his wife are coming to town for a fundraiser on Friday night at the Hilton, something about orphans, or maybe it was refugees, I can't remember. He kind of glossed over the particulars. The point is that he and Naomi bought an entire table and they have two extra seats. Judge Whitmore and her husband will be sitting with them, along with two members of the school board. He said he thought Mike might like to meet them." Mike's eyebrows shoot upward and he sits forward as he says,
"Judge Whitmore's clerkship is one of the most competitive summer positions in town. Half of the people in my class have applied."
"You included," I remind him.
Margot rolls her eyes at this.
"For some reason, I wouldn't be surprised if Caleb Hicks already knows that. Don't tell me you're actually considering telling him you'll go."
"I already said yes," I say.
"It just seemed too good an opportunity to pass up."
"Thanks,"
Mike says. "Well, in that case," Margot decides, "you'll get a chance to observe the weasel in his natural habitat. There has to be some usefulness in that." By Friday, the manuscript is almost done. I text Essie to tell her that I'll have a copy for her by the rehearsal dinner the following night, and that she should wear something with pockets so I can slip her a flash drive. She doesn't text back, and I'm seized by a sudden fit of paranoia that she's found out I'm going to the fundraiser with Caleb and is angry with me. I have to remind myself that most of the time she keeps the phone off and hidden beneath her mattress. So she probably hasn't even gotten the message I just sent. After Googling the fundraiser, I learned that it's not for orphans or even refugees, but for veterans wounded overseas. I try to unravel the thread of memory that's all that's left of my call with Caleb, convinced that I'm so tired that I must have misheard him. But I'm nearly certain that he had said something about Syria and orphaned children. In the end, I decide that he must go to so many fundraisers that they all start to run together, or else he doesn't care enough to try to keep them straight. Margot insists that I let Farai come over to do my hair and makeup, and I reluctantly agree. Mike is out picking up his rented tux when she arrives, so we have the apartment to ourselves. Farai raises one arched eyebrow at the mess in the living room, where Margot sits eating from yet another takeout container. "What?" Margot asks with a withering look of her own, and Farai turns away to usher me into the bathroom. She has brought her own lights and mirror and a case of small tubes and brushes, as well as other sundry beauty products, products that make me angry when I see them advertised on TV, products that tell our generation of women that to be beautiful, we must transform ourselves into something different from what we are. I balk when it is time to look into the mirror, but I have to admit that when Farai has finished, I still look like myself, only brighter, softer, less careworn. She helps me step into my dress so that it doesn't muss the curls she has so painstakingly conjured from my thin blonde hair. Then she steps back and gives me an admiring look. "I've had to be careful when getting you ready for interviews. It wouldn't do to upstage a guest, whoever she might be. I've never really been able to do you justice until now." I stiffen at the sound of my sister's name, even though I know that the mention of it was unintentional. Farai grew up near Pretoria. There's no reason for her to know that I was once famous, and even if she does, she probably doesn't care. She has seen much deeper tragedies than mine firsthand. She has traveled a much more dangerous road. "Thank you," I tell her, stepping back and spinning slowly. The fabric of my dress, green to match my eyes, lifts away from my legs as I twirl, and when I stop, it keeps twisting so it wraps itself around me. It feels cool where it brushes against the backs of my ankles, and though I am again reminded of the feel of Justice's nightgown, this time I'm able to banish the memory the first time I try. I lean forward to readjust a strap on my left shoe, and just then Mike bursts in.
5 minutes,
he says, and starts to unzip the bag that contains his tux. Farai returns to the bathroom to gather her things, and I drift into the living room and perch awkwardly on the arm of the chair where Margot sits, poring over Essie's manuscript. "There," I say, and point. "Yep, got it," Margot answers, and cuts and pastes a paragraph from one section to another. Farai kisses the air in front of my cheeks before she goes, and a few minutes later, Mike emerges from our room. He still looks vaguely flustered, but the tuxedo fits him well. "You look nice," I tell him.
"You too. Very nice. I'm sorry, I should have said that before."
He pats his pocket to reassure himself that his wallet and phone are where they should be. "Ready?" I ask, amused at how nervous he looks.
"I think so. Yes, I'm sure I am."
"Enjoy yourself, kids," Margot calls before the door swings shut. "But not too much, and remember your curfew. Be back before you get brainwashed into thinking Caleb Hicks is an actual human being and not a Borg drone." Caleb and Naomi greet us warmly when we arrive, and Caleb steers Mike expertly into the open seat closest to Judge Whitmore. Only her husband is between them. He's an authority on extinct languages, and has just returned from a month-long research trip to Papua New Guinea. He looks as if the noise and the lights are a bit too much for him. Mike tells a joke and the man laughs, relieved, it seems, that he remembers how. While Naomi compliments my dress or my hair or some combination of the two. I sit down next to her and am relieved when Caleb immediately falls into conversation with the man on his other side. Things go on like this for a while. Then there are speeches. I try to pay attention, but by the fourth speaker, I've started counting the crystals on the chandelier overhead as a way to pass the time. The evening wears on. Mike and Judge Whitmore launch into a heated discussion about the threatened teacher's strike, and eventually swap seats to be next to each other, while Mr. Whitmore regales the woman on his other side with a story about a man he met in Papua New Guinea who hasn't set foot on the ground for more than 50 years, preferring to live out his life on a platform built into the branches of a tree. Before I know it, I'm being swept back toward the coat room, and Judge Whitmore is handing Mike her card. He waves as she and her husband walk toward the doors, and a few minutes later, the coat check returns our jackets and we follow the stream of bodies exiting onto the street. Caleb says something, and I laugh because in that moment it seems funny, and then immediately I feel guilty and forget what it was he'd said.
"It looked like you and Judge Whitmore really hit it off," Caleb tells Mike when we've reached the pavement. "I was hoping that you would."
"Yes, thank you," he says, and I notice the stiffness re-enter his body as he remembers that this is a person we are supposed to hate. I can see this, but I know that Caleb and Naomi would never guess. Mike's coat buzzes faintly, and he fishes his phone out of the pocket of the jacket, checks the number, and looks back up at me.
"Excuse me," Mike says.
Then he moves a few steps away and lifts the cell phone to his ear, while Naomi tells me about how her daughter, Millicent, recently took a pair of scissors to her bangs. This means that she'll have to leave her Easter bonnet on for the entire wedding to keep from ruining the pictures. But it won't really matter because Millicent looks so darling in the bonnet that Naomi would have made her leave it on anyway. Mike rejoins us, and something about his face makes Naomi stop mid-sentence. He takes my wrist and tries to pull me away from Caleb and Naomi, but for some reason I resist. Whatever it is Mike has to say, I don't want to hear it. "Your mom," he says helplessly.
"She's in the hospital. She's unconscious on a breathing tube. They're still not sure what's wrong. Someone will call when they know more."
"You poor dear." Before I can object, Naomi's arms are around me and I can feel that the hug is genuine. Her eyes are misty when she pulls away.
"We'll let you go,"
Caleb says, with the same tone of real concern his wife had just used.
"But please let us know if there's anything we can do."
Somehow, my feet find their way to the car. Mike pulls the seatbelt across my chest. He puts the key into the ignition but doesn't turn it. We sit like that, in silence, until I find the strength to speak. "Why did he call you?" I ask, meaning my father.
"He was afraid you wouldn't answer."
I feel the panic burn my throat. "This is all my fault," I say.
"How on earth do you come to that conclusion? You think that because you told your mother something she didn't want to hear, her body just gave out? That's not how medicine actually works. You need to stop thinking like that. Just like you need to stop thinking that your father blames you for not being there when Justice died. Maybe he said things right after that he shouldn't have. He was grieving. He had just lost a child. It was the grief itself that said those things, not your father. Your parents love you. Otherwise, why would they still be making so much of an effort even after all these years?"
I'm too numb to really consider whether anything Mike has just said is true. And so I say, it doesn't matter. None of it matters now. Mike drives home, and though he turns the radio on at some point, he quickly turns it off again. I watch the streetlights flash by and let my eyes go out of focus until the world is just a blur of light and dark, with nothing in between. Even after we've parked and the engine has cooled, Mike makes no move to get out of the car. A raccoon slinks along the fence and disappears from sight. Not long after, there's a clatter as a trash can is knocked over. The noise breaks something inside me, and I can no longer bear to be sitting there. I can no longer tolerate Mike's sympathy. Well, I'm glad that it happened, in a way. I hear Mike take a breath and hold it. I mean, I'm glad that it happened now, if it was going to happen anyway. Now, at least there's still time to make sure I don't make the same mistake again. I'm not sure I follow. Essie's book. I know she thinks she's thought it through, but she hasn't. I need to make her see that. It's like when you knock over the first domino. Once it topples, you lose control of everything that comes after. There's no way to stop the rest of them from falling down.
Rourke. Blake and I spend Friday driving back and forth from the airport to pick up all my cousins and aunts and uncles who have flown in from out of town for the wedding. By our third trip, we're getting punchy. Laughing so hard we can't breathe, even though neither of us really knows why. And I actually have to stop on the side of the road in order to avoid an accident, because my eyes are filled with tears. In mid-afternoon, we pull up late to the curb outside the arrivals level to find my great-aunt Mildred already waiting. She's clutching her suitcase with one hand while wagging her disapproval with the other. Blake swallows his laughter and nimbly jumps out of the passenger side to take her bag and stow it in the trunk, then opens the car door with a flourish and even throws in a chivalrous bow. Aunt Mildred sniffs in disdain and settles into the back seat. And I wonder for a moment if she has figured out that her impending death, which is supposedly being hastened by an entirely fictitious illness, has been used to justify the timing of the wedding ceremony. I hold my breath, willing her not to blurt out anything incriminating in front of Blake. But though she waits until we have pulled onto the highway before she acknowledges me, when she does, she says, "So, you're selling your soul to the devil, are you, boy?" Relieved, I exhale. "Is that what you think of marriage?"
"I didn't say that. It's what I think of this marriage, though."
"I'm sorry to hear that," I say. And when she offers no further explanation, I add, "You know, you didn't have to come."
"And miss out on the social event of the year? I don't think so. Lily in Palawi has the room across the hall from me at Kissing Pines, and she offered me $1,000 to be my date. That's how badly she wants to meet your bride. I told her thank you, but no thank you. I'm not a lesbian, you see. Besides, she smells like an old lady. If I were going to bring a date, it would be someone good-looking. Maybe someone like you. What's your name, young man?"
Blake introduces himself, repeating what he had said back at the airport when they first met. I try to figure out if Aunt Mildred is losing her marbles or if she's simply deaf.
"So what are they going to do exactly? Brand you? Or cut a cross into your chest?"
She's talking to me now, not to Blake. "That seems a little extreme, don't you think?" I say with a nervous laugh. I can't imagine it would be a good idea to admit that she has a point.
"Extreme? I think that's just the right word for it."
"They're not a cult."
"Oh, no.
Besides, Blake cuts in, S.E. isn't anything like her family. Isn't that what you said? I shoot him a look that I hope says shut up and move into the left lane to pass a rusted-out pickup, reasoning that this trip can't go by quickly enough.
And just what is her family like? Aunt Mildred asks, leaning forward in her seat.
I glance in the rearview mirror and then move my eyes back onto the road, and think how best to answer politely without sounding like I've drunk the Kool-Aid. I don't know. They're just people.
My aunt's eyebrows come together and I sigh. Does anyone really like their in-laws?
For some reason, she seems satisfied with this, and redirects her gaze to what I can only assume is the back of Blake's head.
And you, boy, what do you think of the little missus?
This time, I keep my eyes straight ahead, but I feel my shoulders tense as I wait for him to answer.
Essie?
Blake asks, as if surprised by the question.
She's the best.
The following day is the rehearsal dinner, but first there is the rehearsal itself. I'm still unused to being so near the front of the church, so it's doubly strange to be taken by the hand by Jethro Hicks himself and steered up the steps that lead to the altar. I remember how Celia Hicks once said that her husband's eyes were the same shade of blue as her son Caleb's. At the time, I never imagined I'd stand close enough to either of them to tell, or that I would even care. But I see now that what she said was true. They are the same, down to the tiny flecks of lavender at their centers. Pastor Hicks arranges us on the stairs, which are decorated with chips of different colored stone to form a mosaic. I'm standing with my foot on the head of a serpent, which seems fitting. Caleb's right beside me with Blake on the step below. Early on, there had been a plan for Essie and me to be flanked by her brothers and their wives, but a focus group had found this far too kitschy, which goes to show that focus groups sometimes get it right. So next to Blake is Reggie, who has agreed to be here only because I told him that being one of my groomsmen would be like giving the Hicks family the metaphorical finger, and he's wanted to do that for years. I was allowed two groomsmen of my own, plus Caleb, who was apparently non-negotiable, to stand opposite Essie's three bridesmaids, Naomi, Hillary, and Lucy. Then, after Lyssa crashed the party and volunteered to be Essie's number four, we found ourselves short one young man. Celia Hicks insisted that it be someone from my family, and, after reviewing photographs of each of my relatives, she chose my cousin Rand, whom I met once when I was five, and who lives with his mother somewhere near Flagstaff. Rand has done some modeling for Abercrombie and Fitch, something I'm guessing Celia Hicks is well aware of. Still, I have to admit that Rand was an excellent choice, as he seems to get along well with Blake and Reggie, while harboring an instant dislike of Caleb. So I'm happy enough to have him standing by my side. For some reason, this process of deciding just where each of us should stand takes at least 20 minutes, during which all five of the cameras check their angles and the lighting. When Celia and Candy are finally satisfied, they send Gretchen scurrying forward to mark the stairs with different colored pieces of tape, so when the time comes, we'll remember exactly where we should be. The cameramen for this part of the broadcast are all veterans of Six for Hicks, from what I gather. Margot and Libby will have access beforehand, and then again for the grand finale. When Libby interviews Essie and me on the steps of the church, just before Essie tosses her bouquet into the waiting crowd. The other networks will be there too, but Essie has said she'll only speak directly to Libby. I guess she means it as a thank you to Libby for drumming up all the publicity she has, but in any case,
it means that they're absent from this rehearsal. And I find I almost miss them. I don't know that the Hicks elders have ever laid eyes on Margot or her purple hair. I'm hoping that I get to